This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are exposed. And in this new series, we investigate the dark side of the wellness industry, following the story of a woman who joined a yoga school only to uncover a world she never expected.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this.
Where the hope of spiritual breakthroughs leaves people vulnerable to exploitation.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
World of Secrets, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Richtig spannend, richtig vielfältig. Das ist deine Karriere bei Kaufland. Ob Trainee-Programm, Direkteinstieg, Studentenjob oder Praktikum. Finde bei uns den Einstieg, der zu dir passt. Profitiere von einer attraktiven Vergütung, spannenden Aufgaben und individuellen Entwicklungsmöglichkeiten. Werde jetzt Teil unseres Teams. Bewirb dich jetzt unter kaufland.de/studenten. Kaufland, hier bin ich richtig.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 4th of January, these are our main stories. In a nail-biting vote, the Speaker of the US House of Representatives, Mike Johnson, who's been backed by Donald Trump, narrowly holds on to his job. President Joe Biden blocks the takeover of America's third biggest steelmaker by a Japanese company. Hamas says that indirect negotiations with Israel have resumed in Qatar for a ceasefire in Gaza and the release of Israeli hostages. Also in this podcast...
Hey Siri.
Uh-huh.
Have you been recording my private conversations?
Sorry, I don't understand.
The tech giant Apple agrees to pay a settlement of $95 million after users accused its virtual assistant Siri of spying on them. We begin in Washington at the U.S. Capitol.
The Honorable Mike Johnson of the state of Louisiana, having received a majority of the votes cast, is duly elected Speaker of the House of Representatives for the 119th Congress.
Where the Republican Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives managed to snatch the narrowest of victories from the jaws of defeat. There was confusion on Friday, as it seemed that Mike Johnson, who's been backed by U.S. President-elect Donald Trump, had lost the vote to remain in his role, with a handful of Republicans in the lower chamber voting against him or abstaining. But then, after huddled discussions, nearly all of them changed their minds, giving Mr. Johnson 218 votes, the lowest possible number for him to be re-elected to his post. After the vote, he took to the House floor.
What we're proposing now is just simply, as President Trump likes to say, a return to common sense. And he's exactly right. That message resonated across the country. I am very thankful, personally, that this body is filled with men and women who are committed to that change, to return to common sense. We can do this together. We should. It is our responsibility to do so.
House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries called on both Republicans and Democrats to come together and promised that his party would work to find common ground with Republicans.
The American people need us as their elected representatives in this season to put down our partisan swords and pick up bipartisan plowshares. It's time for us to come together, not as Democrats or Republicans, but as Americans.
Our correspondent in the Capitol building, Rowan Bridge, told me more about the vote.
I think if there was confusion around it, it was because there had been a vote, but the vote hadn't officially been announced. And so what you had is people were totting up the numbers as the voting was going through and going, "Ah, Mike Johnson, I can't win here." But then before the vote was officially announced, there was clearly some arm-twisting and back-scratching going on the floor of Congress. And that was enough to win over two holdouts. And those two holdouts then voted in favour of Mike Johnson. And that, then when the vote came to be announced, meant he had enough votes to carry the gavel and to hold on to the speakership.
And do we know how those dissenting Republicans were persuaded to change their minds?
Yeah, I mean, we've heard from one of them, and they said that they were given commitments around spending, which is a big thing for some of those conservative Republicans who are concerned about the levels of public spending in the United States, and also about making sure that they can pass Trump's sort of America First agenda. But also worth noting, like, in the drama of that vote at the beginning, there were some Johnson critics who effectively sat on their hands. They didn't vote at all. And then as it came towards the end of the vote, they did end up voting for him. But I think that was them telegraphing, hey, listen, don't take us for granted going forward. You're going to need us for some of these votes.
And what does this tell us about how a Donald Trump second term will be like? Because we're already seeing, even before he comes back to the White House, how divided the Republicans are.
Yeah, I mean, I think Mike Johnson is going to be key for Donald Trump going forward, because the reason that speakership role is so significant is that it controls the passage of legislation through the House of Representatives. And for Donald Trump, having an ally in that position will be significant. And Donald Trump went out publicly sort of supporting Mike Johnson. And so he's also shown the level of influence that he can. And it also, I think, shows that Republicans are serious about governing, that this didn't descend into a sort of circus of 15 votes over 4 days to get a speaker, as we've had previously. At the same time, so those are all the sort of positives, if you like. On the other side, you know, Mike Johnson's got a very small majority to work with here, and there is a very conservative wing of the party who are not very happy with Mike Johnson, even if they voted for him, and they could cause trouble going forward, certainly.
Rowan Bridge. In an extraordinary move from a US president who's just weeks away from leaving office, Joe Biden has blocked the takeover of America's third biggest steelmaker, US Steel, by a Japanese company, Nippon Steel. The White House spokeswoman, Karine Jean-Pierre, said Mr. Biden wanted to protect the US from foreign competitors who use unfair trade practices.
It is critical that we have a strong domestic steel industry that protects our national security and our supply chains. Today, the president demonstrated once again that he will always act to protect the security of this nation, as well as the resilience of our supply.
The deal would have been worth nearly $15 billion. Mr. Biden's intervention follows fierce opposition from the United Steelworkers Union. Both companies have responded by saying it's truly shocking that the US government would treat a major ally like Japan in this way. Our North America business correspondent Michelle Fleury told me more about why President Biden had blocked the deal.
You're talking about a sort of once iconic American business, US Steel. It was once the biggest company in America, but it has fallen on hard times. And this deal to buy it by Nippon Steel was meant to be kind of a lifeline that was going to inject much needed money into the company site just outside of Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania to revive its fortunes and kind of future proof it, if you like. But right from the beginning, it was controversial, both in economic terms. Critics were concerned that because Nippon Steel was Japanese, that maybe jobs in the US would be lost. There was some support from politicians locally on that front. There was also concern that this was happening in a swing state during an election year. And so you saw both President Biden, but also President-elect Donald Trump coming out against this deal. And now we've got confirmation of that in one of his last acts as president, Joe Biden now blocking this deal, saying that it was bad on national security grounds and that it was critical to preserve not just US jobs, but also US supply chains.
And is this the end of the matter? Because both Nippon Steel and US Steel have responded angrily with, it seems, some threat of legal action.
Yeah, I mean, look, Nippon Steel had sort of bent over backwards to try and kind of accommodate the concerns from American politicians. I mean, they'd even gone so far as to say they were going to give veto power to the company over future decisions to kind of downsize US operations. But that wasn't enough to win approval. And now Nippon Steel and US Steel have said they are going to take all appropriate action to protect their legal rights. In other words, they plan to challenge Biden's move in court. Part of this has to do with kind of how the process played out. There is a regulatory body whose job is to kind of review foreign investment and decide whether or not there's a national security concern. And that committee actually was unable to reach a decision. And so it was sort of punted to the administration, to the White House, to make the final call. And they're saying that the whole process kind of wasn't fair. So I suspect that will be the legal argument, that they will kind of try and push the government to provide evidence of what this national security concern is exactly, especially when you're talking about a Japanese buyer of an American firm. Remember, Japan is a big US ally.
Michelle Fleury. Hamas says indirect ceasefire talks with Israel have resumed in the Qatari capital, Doha. The long-running stop-start negotiations had recently ground to a halt, with both sides blaming each other. Here's our Middle East regional editor, Mike Thompson.
The good news is they're talking again, but sticking points remain. Hamas has said discussions will focus on a complete end to hostilities and an Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. Yet so far, Israel has rejected any deal that guarantees a permanent end to the conflict before its war aims are achieved. There are also differences over which hostages would be released by Hamas and the names of prisoners to be freed in exchange by Israel. As pressure for a ceasefire grows, Israel has stepped up its bombardment of the territory, with more than 100 people reported killed over the last 2 days.
Mike Thompson. Syria has tightened restrictions on its border with Lebanon for the first time since the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad last month. Both countries have been keen to express their desire for a new relationship after decades in which Damascus has dominated its smaller neighbour. Sebastian Usher reports from Beirut.
Just a week ago, anyone taking the Masnaa border crossing from Lebanon into Syria only needed their passport to be waved through with a smile by border guards who'd taken over from officials appointed under Bashar al-Assad's rule. That's just changed to some degree, with Lebanese nationals now needing a Syrian residency permit or official permission to enter. It could be in response to recent border incidents, including a clash between armed Syrians and Lebanese troops. But it may also be a tit-for-tat measure for Lebanon, already only allowing Syrians with Lebanese residency into the country. Either way, it means that taxis are no longer able to drive the whole route between Beirut and Damascus.
Sebastian Usher. The tech giant Apple has agreed to pay a $95 million settlement to users who accuse its digital assistant, Siri, of listening in on their private conversations. The BBC's Isabella Bull decided to ask Siri itself about the allegations.
Hey Siri.
Uh-huh.
Have you been recording my private conversations?
Sorry, I don't understand.
Have you been listening to me?
I respect your privacy and only listen when you're talking to me. You can learn about Apple's approach to privacy at apple.com.
So Siri, why is Apple settling a lawsuit over you?
I found this on the web.
Okay, I can see you've brought up the BBC News article about this lawsuit. Can you explain it to me?
Apple means the round fruit of a tree of the rose family, which typically has thin green or red skin and crisp flesh. Do you want to hear the remaining one?
No thanks, Siri, that's okay.
Isabella Bull there talking to a rather evasive Siri. Well, BBC technology reporter Imran Rahman Jones told me more about the case.
This is to do with Siri, the voice-activated smart assistant that is on lots of Apple devices, their watches, iPhones, iPads, etc. Most people with smart speakers or other devices know you have to give it an activation word in order for it to start listening, and then you can give it your commands. In this case, it's "Hey Siri." What the claimants say is that they hadn't said those words and it started listening into their conversations without their permission. The way these class action lawsuits work is there's a small number of plaintiffs who bring the case to the court. So among those in the court documents, one of the lead plaintiffs, a woman called Fumiko Lopez in California, who says she and her daughter were both recorded. And the evidence they give is they were talking about specific products. So something like Air Jordans, which they give in the court documents, the Nike trainers. They were talking about that. They then alleged that they were recorded by Apple and then they were served targeted ads to do with those specific shoes. Another example given in the court papers is of a man who had a conversation with his doctor about a specific type of surgery which they were considering. And he said he'd never searched this on his devices before, but once he'd had that conversation with the doctor, then adverts to do with this specific type of surgery then started coming up on his devices. And he says that's evidence that he was being listened to, in this case by his Apple Watch.
And now after this 5-year legal case. There's been this settlement. Tell us about it and its significance.
So Apple have offered to pay $95 million to settle the case. It still needs a judge in the court in Northern California to accept it and for it to go through. But if it does in February, then it would mean that Apple payout, it seems a huge amount of money, but it's over a few million people who would be eligible to claim. That's how these class action lawsuits work. So it would end up being probably about $20 per person per device. But as part of that settlement, Apple would deny any wrongdoing at all and say that any claims that it recorded, disclosed to third parties, or failed to delete conversations without consent would be denied.
And it seems like a huge amount of money to you and me, but for Apple, it's just a drop in the ocean. What's the significance of this for Apple, given that it's made user privacy a big part of its brand? Is the case itself more damaging than the actual financial settlement?
Like you say, Apple put user privacy front and centre of lots of its marketing, and it's the way that it tries to distinguish itself against its rivals. So if anything was to come out, and it hasn't yet, that they were listening into people without their consent, then that would be a big blow to them. Like you also say, $95 million is a lot of money, but they made $95 billion in just 3 months up to the end of September last year. So we're talking about a tiny amount.
BBC technology reporter Imran Rahman Jones. Still to come.
We don't really understand why she's carrying this deceased calf for so long. But of course, as humans, we can relate, of course, because we understand grief.
The story of the killer whale who made headlines around the world when she was filmed carrying the dead body of her calf.
Delve into a world of secrets. The BBC's Global Investigations podcast, breaking major news stories around the world.
A BBC investigation finds that Mohamed Al-Fayed, former owner of Harrods, was accused of raping five members of staff.
Mohamed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
From the top of British society to the heart of global fashion brands.
The former boss of clothing brand Abercrombie and Fitch is accused of exploiting young men for sex.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
Gripping investigations, available to listen to now, with more coming soon. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts and click follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast. South Korea has one of the lowest fertility rates in the world, but now for the first time in nearly a decade, it's seen a rise in the number of births. But as Steve Jackson reports, its population is still in steady decline.
South Korea's low birth rate has been described as a national emergency, and the government has poured billions of dollars into encouraging people to have more children. Among other measures are cheaper mortgages for parents, tax breaks for family-friendly businesses, and more parental leave. The figures just released for 2024 show a 3% rise in the number of births, a small step in the right direction, but nowhere near enough to prevent long-term population decline. A fifth of South Koreans are over 65, and with the number of deaths far surpassing births, the population is projected to halve in size by the end of the century.
Steve Jackson, and did you know that babies born in 2025 will be the first to belong to Generation Beta? But what does that actually mean? Andrew Peach heard more from Sinead Butler, a trends reporter at the Indy 100 news site.
Generation Beta are people born between 2025 and 2039. So babies born from the 1st of January this year are the first of the Gen Bs. And by 2035, they will make up 16% of the global population. And most of the members of this generation are actually expected to live well into the 22nd century as well.
I was going to say that the first generation that will belong to the next century, I guess
yeah, exactly.
they're going to have a life pretty much dominated by AI, we would, from our vantage point now, you would think, anyway.
Yeah, especially now, yeah, with like kind of technology such as artificial intelligence is quickly developing right now. So in the next few decades, it's only going to further advance, and they'll be growing up with that technology as well. It'll be similar to kind of how Gen Alpha were dubbed the iPad kids due to how that technology had an impact on their childhoods. And it'll be interesting to see that relationship develop in the decades to come.
So we've got Gen Beta now taking over from Gen Alpha. I'm Gen X myself. I was born in 1973. I suspect you're a millennial. You sound, I'm guessing, I'm going to put money on you being a millennial.
I'll take that as a compliment. I'm Gen Z.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what are the sort of, does it mean anything, I suppose, is what I'm going to say. The people are born, in similar periods, going to have different experiences of life, I suppose. What else do we take from these labels?
I guess with kind of like technology nowadays, especially like Gen Z and Gen Alpha, and obviously with Gen Beta, social media plays such a huge aspect in connecting with people. So I think in terms of the generations, when you look at the differences in like growing up, that's had a huge impact on how we communicate with people and their kind of experiences in society.
Yeah, and I guess in the end it's a useful label, isn't it? And the cutoff date is a bit arbitrary, but it's a useful label to describe who we're talking about without needing to give the date of birth out.
Yeah, exactly. So if you don't want to give your age away, it's always a good indicator.
What's been the reaction online to the name Gen Beta? Do people like that?
So overall, there's been a lot of reaction on social media. I think with this new generation, it makes us all reflect on where we are in life, like coming to terms with the fact that we're all getting older and there's like a new generation of youngsters. And I think Gen Z have taken it particularly hard, with some of them saying they're officially like the new millennials. And then there's kind of like references to like the 2024 horror film The Substance, which kind of tackles the topic of aging. And then you have like people making fun of the name kind of Gen Beta due to like the negative connotations of the word beta, which is a slang term for someone who's kind of perceived to be weak, mild-mannered, passive, kind of the opposite of alpha. So people have been joking that like Gen Beta are going to have these characteristics. Some people were joking about how people were rushing to have babies before 2025, so their children were Gen Alpha and not Gen Beta.
That was Sinead Butler from the Indy 100 news site talking to Andrew Peach. Passport holders from any African country can now travel to Ghana without needing a visa. The move is part of a wider shift towards freedom of movement across the continent. Ghana joins Rwanda, the Seychelles, the Gambia and Benin in offering visa-free entry for African travellers. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, reports.
Before this policy was introduced, nationals of more than 20 African countries needed to get visas on arrival in Ghana. Just days before stepping down, President Nana Akufo-Addo said he was proud to have brought in the new policy. He said scrapping the visas was a logical step towards building the African Continental Free Trade Area, which is expected to be the world's largest trading bloc. Ghana clearly sees the value of making it easier to visit. 2019 was dubbed the Year of Return and attracted a large number of mostly African Americans, a move which helped give a much-needed boost to a struggling economy.
Will Ross. You may recall back in 2018 the story of a killer whale who swam more than 1,600 kilometres, pushing the body of her dead newborn calf. Well, the same whale, known as Talekwa, has had a healthy calf since then, but she's now been spotted again with another dead baby, which she is again carrying in the Puget Sound off the coast of the US state of Washington and British Columbia in Canada. Anis Ramili is editor-in-chief of the Whale Scientist blog. Julian Marshall asked her how common Talekwa's behaviour is among killer whales.
It's happened a couple of times before, but never this long. And of course, this is baffling for all of us scientists. We don't really understand why she's carrying this diseased calf for so long. But of course, as humans, we can relate, of course, because we understand grief. And it's very difficult to explain grief for a species that we cannot properly communicate with and that we don't fully understand.
But your guess would be that Talekwa is experiencing grief.
Absolutely. These killer whales are social creatures, and we know they form important bonds with their family members of their pods. And so the fact that she's carrying this calf for so long shows that she has some emotions, because of course it costs her a lot of energy to push this calf around. Last time it was for over 1,000 miles and over 2 weeks. So it is not something that's easy for her to do, because while she's pushing the calf, she cannot feed properly. So it's not overreaching to say that she's grieving.
More troubling, though, perhaps, is why she has lost a calf for the second time.
I think it's just worth noting that in between the two events, she did have a healthy calf. Its name is Phoenix, or J57, and it was born in the fall of 2020. And this calf did make it past its first year. It's still healthy. It's still alive. But of course, this is extremely troubling. And this is, in this case, a female. And we know that this population is lacking females. There's only 23 reproductive females left in this population and 73 individuals. And we know that we need all the females that we can get to bring this population back to healthy numbers.
Why has this particular killer whale population dwindled, though?
So there's a bunch of different factors. It is a population that lives in close proximity to a very populated human area. And so, of course, that introduces a lot of issues. And we know that it's a population that loves to feed on Chinook salmon. And we know that there's competition with humans. There's also a lack of salmon due to a lot of dams being built on the rivers where the salmons reproduce. And so there's a lack of food for southern resident killer whales, and we know it because they have generally poor body condition.
Anise Ramili, editor-in-chief of the Whale Scientists blog. Now, when you've had too much of the news, there's nothing like a bit of entertainment to lift the spirits. So what releases can we look forward to in 2025? The senior awards editor of Variety magazine, Clayton Davis, spoke to James Kumarasamy.
You're going to see a lot of franchises. Marvel has a good slate, including Thunderbolts, but also we're going to get Fantastic Four, which I think is one of the biggest excitements for superhero fans, not only because it's Pedro Pascal, who is stepping into the lead role of Mr. Fantastic, along with a great cast.
We're also going to be seeing some remakes, aren't we? One that struck us here, the Kiss of the Spider Woman.
A story of love creates a passion, a danger.
So Kiss of the Spider-Woman is getting a reimagining based off of the Broadway musical. This stars Jennifer Lopez in many ways, the role that she's probably waited for her entire career. This is the Sonia Braga role that was made famous in the 80s, playing essentially three different roles. And this is something that I think could surprise us in a significant way.
It's a bit like Hairspray, isn't it? Coming a film, then becomes a musical, and then becomes a film again.
I mean, that's where people tend to find comfort. You find comfort in the things that you know. For a marketing department at any type of major studio, that's easier to sell. You know, I mean, that's why we have Wicked Part 2 coming, now titled Wicked for Good, next year. Part 2, and if anyone's familiar with the Broadway show, does run adjacent to the timeline of Wizard of Oz.
Snow White is pretty familiar, isn't it? And that's getting an interesting remake.
Magic mirror on the wall. Who is the fairest of them all?
Famed is thy beauty, Majesty.
And listen, Disney has spent a lot of money on this. Some of those early murmurs don't seem to bring a lot of confidence into what it can actually deliver in terms of box office. The trailer wasn't very well received. It's always good to remind everyone that 2020 was the time that accelerated the conversation that we all were trying to avoid. How can streamers and movie theaters coexist? So I think what we're seeing now is the great reduction, I believe, is still occurring. And when I say great reduction, you know, everyone tried to get into the streaming game because everyone was chasing Netflix. I will say that there will be certain movies that have a harder time getting made than live event space is the next natural go-to for them.
Variety's Senior Awards Editor, Clayton Davis. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition was mixed by Tom Bartlett. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
What do Tiger Woods, Mark Zuckerberg, and Taylor Swift all have in common? Well, their lives and fortunes are all being discussed on Good Bad Billionaire, the podcast exploring the minds, motives, and the money of some of the world's wealthiest individuals. I'm Xing Xing, and each week my co-presenter Simon Jack and I take a closer look at the world's mega rich, and we try to decide whether they're good, bad, or just another billionaire. From celebs and CEOs to sports stars and tech titans, find out how billionaires made their money and how they use it. Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service. All episodes of Season 1 and 2 are available now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts. And click follow or subscribe so you never miss a new episode.